Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You are listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Lauren Corman here with Carl Orzechowski, teching for us today. We have a very exciting program, as always, lined up. It's a huge honor to have the next guest on our program. We're speaking with Ramona Africa today, who is a member of MOVE and the sole adult survivor of the May 13th, 1985 police bombing of the MOVE house in Philadelphia, which killed 11 people. Ramona Africa, after that point, was sentenced and served time. She did 7 years for a number of different alleged crimes, conspiracy, riot, multiple counts of simple and aggravated assault. No police officers were ever indicted in the massacre, despite the special commission evidence that indicated their culpability. In today's interview, we're going to be talking with Ramona, who is the MOVE Minister of Communication, and she's going to tell us about the MOVE 9, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and all political prisoners and prisoners of war, who she's working on behalf of right now. She's also going to tell us about John Africa's message of respect and reverence for life, and how this translated into actions for animals, people, and the earth. It's a huge honor to have you on the program today. Welcome, Ramona.
On the MOVE, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So can you bring us back to the beginning of MOVE and tell us about who John Africa was and how you personally got involved in the organization?
Okay. Well, the MOVE organization is a revolutionary organization, as you said, founded by John Africa back in the very early 1970s. And John Africa brought people together from various races, religions, social, economic backgrounds, and really brought us together as a family and cementing that bond of family with one single common fundamental principle, the principle of life, life being the priority, whether it's animal life, human life, the environment, that there is nothing more important than life. And when you believe in life and you're protective of life, then you understand that life is coordinated by the mother of life, Mother Nature, to be free, you know, to be healthy, satisfied, to be productive. And you also begin to realize that the system that we live in and live under absolutely goes against all of that. Everything about this man-made system is about enslaving, imprisoning, poisoning, maiming, killing, polluting life, whether it's human, animal, the environment, whatever. And because MOVE people believe in life, are very first demonstrations in support of life was at the zoo, at the circus, at Ferrier's, and we demonstrated against the abuse and enslavement of animal life. We had demonstrations at boarding homes for the elderly, where elderly people were really physically and emotionally abused, and their Social Security checks were all but stolen from them. We demonstrated at the Board of Education behind the misdirection of young people and the bullying of young people. And for simply having peaceful demonstrations and speaking out in defense of life, we became targeted by the system. Now, I lived in Philadelphia, in West Philadelphia, all my life, and I graduated high school in 1973. MOVE was in its early stages, but had existed for a couple of years by then. And I began to hear about MOVE, you know, read about MOVE in the newspapers, hear about MOVE on the TV and radio news. But at that point, I guess because I was young or whatever, it just wasn't time. I sympathized with MOVE, but I had no desire to, like, go to MOVE and really find out what was going on or to get involved. I think it just wasn't my time, I guess, because in 1979, early 1979, like March, February or March, I did become so inclined. But this was after the first major police attack on me. A friend that I had met, a brother named Mel, called me and asked me, did I want to go to a meeting to plan a MOVE demonstration? And at that point in early 1979, I guess I was ready. And I was like, yeah, you know, I've heard about MOVE, read about MOVE for years. I really would like to know more about what MOVE is all about, what MOVE represents. So I went to this meeting, and my life was really changed forever. I was a senior, I think, in my last year at Temple University, majoring in political science, a pre-law curriculum. And I was planning on going to law school that fall, becoming a lawyer, then possibly a judge. And, I mean, you can't get more systematic than that. But that's where I was headed. And I met MOVE supporters at this meeting. I was encouraged to go over to City Hall where hearings were going on, you know, for MOVE political prisoners. And I just, my whole life changed after that, because what I saw going on in that courtroom was nothing like what these professors and those textbooks told me was supposed to happen in courtrooms, you know. And I was shocked and amazed and also very impressed with MOVE people who were representing themselves in court and doing an excellent job of it. I mean, exposing the lies that police witnesses were telling, and it was obvious that MOVE people were not intimidated at all by the judge or any other court official. And I mean, they were fighting for their lives and were not intimidated at all, and I was very impressed. I was very impressed, and I started going up to the prison to visit MOVE people, you know, talk to them personally, and that was it for me. I knew at that point that I did not want to be like the lawyers, the prosecuting attorneys, the judge. I wanted to be like MOVE people, and you know, that's where I headed. I never did go to law school. I had been accepted. I was going to go that fall, but I made the decision. MOVE people didn't convince me or try to encourage me not to go to law school. I made that decision, and I've never regretted it, because I became a real lawyer. And I went to court when I was on trial. I represented myself. You know, I was able to do that. So I've never regretted it.
You talked about, obviously you've been talking about the judicial system, legal system, and in the documentary, the MOVE documentary, one of the members talks about the system being not just the judicial system, but the system being everywhere, including even within us. Can you tell us a bit more about MOVE's work against the system and what MOVE means by the system?
What MOVE means by the system, when we talk about the system, we mean anything and everything outside of life. That's a pretty huge thing, because we don't realize how much our lives have been influenced by things outside of Mother Nature, outside of the natural order of things. I mean, from the way humans are born in hospitals with drugs and delivery rooms and instruments, etc., that has nothing to do with life. That's the system. No other species of life, not one, goes to hospitals to have babies, to do something as natural as have a baby. The way we eat, this system have trained women that despite the fact that you have breasts that have milk in your breast when you have a baby, they train you to feed your baby something else, something from the system, formulas, you know. And then after that, they train you to eat and to feed your children cooked food, processed food. No other species of life cooks their food or eats processed food on their own. That's the system. No other species of life sends their children to school or goes to school. Everything that you need to live in this system is taught to their children through their parents and through, you know, the example of living, except in humans. And while people try to rationalize this by saying, well, you know, humans, we have brains, we can think, you know, we're rational beings, but where is the example of it? Everything that humanity have touched, humanity have poisoned and caused problems. Every single thing, without fail, without exception. You know, animals don't poison their environments. They don't create police. They don't create bombs and guns and pollution and trash and, you know, none of that comes from any other species of life except humans. So when we talk about the system, we're talking about anything and everything outside of life. Life gave us the sun, which never blows out, which never goes cold. But humans created the light bulb, the imitation sun, which blows out and fails regularly. Life, Mama Nature, gave us beautiful birds that glorify the sky. Humans created a metal bird that causes pollution and drops out of the sky and kills hundreds of people, you know? So when we talk about the system, we're talking about everything outside of life's system.
When you talked about some of the actions that MOVE put, obviously took this philosophy that you're just mentioning and put into practice, and you mentioned some of the early work around zoos. There was work around providing healthy food for people, helping elderly people, doing work with neighborhood gangs. Why did MOVE choose to move around these issues in particular, and what kind of response did MOVE have in the beginning? I know that you didn't get involved until after, I think you said, 1979.
Right.
But can you tell us about those sort of initial campaigns that were done a little bit more in depth?
Well, what we would do is, first of all, we set an example. We had twin Victorian houses, and therefore we had two yards. And in the backyards, we would turn. We had a big section of it. We would turn the dirt over, and we would what people today call composting. We would put, you know, potato peelings and banana peelings and all of that into, you know, the earth. We would recycle it into the earth, and that made the dirt fertile and grew things. I mean, we would just throw orange seeds and apple seeds and grape seeds and stuff into the earth, and you know, food started growing, watermelon seeds. At that point, a lot of people were horrified, and, you know, the media just hyped it up because the media is part of the system and was determined to, you know, stop MOVE by trying to discredit MOVE and paint a picture of us that would horrify people. And they started going crazy. Oh, my God, they're throwing garbage in the backyard. They stink. They're nasty. They're filthy, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, years later, they put a, you know, a little word called composting on it, and now it's the thing to do, you know. Mm. But we were doing that back then. We would build wood-burning stoves for elderly people whose heating got cut off because they couldn't afford to pay it. You know, we would provide wood for them. We would take big baskets of fresh food to them, fresh vegetables, fruits, you know, potatoes and stuff. We did this at Osage, too, as well as in Powhatan back then. We would shovel people's payments when it snowed, like shovel all the way around the block, particularly in front of older people's homes so that they wouldn't slip and fall. And we wouldn't take a dime for doing it. We did it for the work and to look out, you know, for people. These were the things that we did. Our coordinator, John Africa, when he was in town, when we lived at Osage, he would bake fresh bread and send it, you know, to our neighbors, to people in the neighborhood. I mean, these were the things that we did, as well as talk to people about what was going on, give them information about what this system was doing to all of us. All of us, without exception, because people hallucinate that if you're rich, if you live a certain lifestyle, that you're immune to certain things. But you're not. You're not immune from cancer and disease that comes with poisoning the environment, because when you poison your environment, you poison yourself, because you're not separate from your environment. You're part of it, you know. So we would talk to people about this, about how nobody is immune, not the richest person, the highest social status person. I mean, look at the Kennedys, you know. They have it all, the so-called American dream, the money, the social status, all of it. But they're riddled with cancer and disease. They're drug addicts, alcoholics, womanizers, whores. I mean, if they were so happy, if living that certain lifestyle is what made you immune from everything and was the foundation of happiness, then why aren't they happy? Is alcoholism a sign of satisfaction, stability, happiness? Is being a whore or a womanizer a sign of satisfaction, stability, you know, happiness, peace of mind? Is drug addiction? No. So what we talk to people about is how that is not the root of happiness, and how everybody is victimized by this system in one way or another, and that the root of happiness and health and satisfaction is in life. And until people start putting priority, making life the priority, then we're not going anywhere. We're going to continue to go downhill. Because, you see, this system did not always exist. This is what John Africa teaches us. This system did not always exist. And from the point of the inception of this system, things have never, ever gotten better. They have consistently gotten worse. You got more crime, more disease, more alcoholism, drug addiction, more pollution, everything. I mean, you have dogs, cats that have cancer, AIDS. Where would they get that from? That's not coming from them. That's humanity's creation. Animals have nothing to do with that, but they've been inflicted with that because of man. And you see, humans are the only species that strayed from life, from the coordination of nature. Humans. No other species until they're affected by humans and humanity. The wildest creatures are the healthiest creatures that live in harmony with life. But when man domesticates animals and has any kind of control or anything over animals or the environment or anything, you see what happens, don't you? You know?
I wanted to ask you quickly before we take our break, because you have done a good job of talking about humanity's break from animal species, the rest of natural species,
all of life
on Earth.
Yeah.
And part of what MOVE did, obviously, is to go back to those teachings and find the wisdom of John Africa. And I was wondering if you could tell us about where humanity or at least parts of humanity went wrong? Where did it, how did it begin? Why did we stray?
Very simply, with a question and arrogance. Man hallucinating that we can do it better than Mama Nature. Looking at something and questioning and feeling that, well, why can't we do it this way? I mean, instead of being content with walking on our own mobility, when the question came, well, why can't we go faster? If we had something that would roll, something like a wheel, then, you know, maybe we could go further and faster. From the instant we started questioning the natural order of things and hallucinating that we could do it different, meaning do it better, that is where humanity went wrong. We can't do it better than nature. I mean, everything that humanity creates fails. It has problems. It's not perfect. Because we are not perfect. But Mother Nature, the God of life, is, and she knows what she's doing. And everything in life was working, until man decided to mess with it and so-called improve. You know, how can you improve on something that's proven? You ever heard that old adage? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yep.
Well.
Ramona, we're going to take a short break.
Okay.
And then we'll come back. And I wanted to hear more about some of the activism that MOVE did, specifically around circuses and zoos. But I really want to make sure that we give time to talk about the MOVE 9 and
okay.
Mumia Abu-Jamal and those okay. cases and where they're at right now. So sort of
okay.
two more parts, big parts to come up before we're done the interview. So we'll try
okay.
to squeeze in. Thank you so much, Ramona.
No
just stay
problem.
On the line. Hi there, welcome back to Animal Voices CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. If you have any questions or comments about this program or any other shows that you've heard on Animal Voices, do write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. You can also go to our website, animalvoices.ca, and check out any of our 190-plus interviews. We're actually coming up to our 200th archived show on Animal Voices, and you can download all those shows for free. Today we're speaking with Ramona Africa, a member of MOVE, the Minister of Communication for MOVE, and we were talking before the break about some of the actions and philosophies that have informed MOVE throughout the years, and I wanted to turn back to our conversation a little bit more in depth about the protest that MOVE did around zoos, pet shops, and circuses, and find out about how people responded to them as they were doing their protests and why these issues were important. So, Ramona,
yeah,
thank
okay.
you so much for being here and welcome
no
back.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay.
We really appreciate every opportunity that we have to put out information to people to share the teachings of John Africa. When we first started our demonstrations, like at the zoo and the circus, you had a few people, some people that were sympathetic. But when we identified ourselves as revolutionaries, a lot of activists and revolutionary people at that time looked at us like we were crazy, and people like, well, what does that have to do with revolution? You're out here talking about animals and the cops is, you know, killing people, blah, blah, blah. And we explained to people that unless you are talking about freedom and protection for all life, then you're not talking about freedom or protection, because the very prejudice that will have humans thinking they are superior to animals, and that animals, you know, are insignificant and have no feelings and are inferior and don't deserve any consideration, it's the same mentality that racist white people, you know, white people that are racist, have about people of color. It's the same superior attitude that men have about women, you know, that adults have about children. You're talking about prejudice. You're talking about that level of superior and inferior. Move through the teaching of John Africa understands that you have to eliminate that mentality if you're talking about freedom, if you're talking about the principle of equality. It doesn't begin and end with humans. You have to believe in that principle across the board, because all life, all living things come from one source. So how can anything about it be inferior or superior if it's all coming from the same source? And this is the kind of information we would give people. When we went and demonstrated at Ferrier's, we would defy people to explain why they felt like they had the right to trap and slaughter animals in mass, like fox and rabbits and seals, minks, and skin them of their coats and put it on humans' backs as if the seal's coat looked better on the human than it did on the seal that the mother of life put it on. And at the same time, condemn and criticize Hitler for taking Jews and skinning them and making lampshades out of their skin. You know? It's the same mentality. And we would give people these examples and really, you know, work hard to get people to understand that life is one thing, and to not categorize life, and to understand that all life is important and it all comes from the same source. So, you know, these were the things that we would do. And like I said, some people thought that we were, you know, a little off our rockers at the time. But the information would start penetrating because it's so simple and it can't be disputed. You know, it's the truth. It's the truth. Just like we humans feel pain, feel everything, so does all life. I mean, you think mama, the body of life that we call the earth, doesn't feel all of that pollution that we poison her with? Think she doesn't feel the gouging of her body for her ores and resources like gold and silver and zinc? And you think we're not affected by it? The ores that we take out of the earth is supposed to be in our food. And when you take it from the earth and prostitute it, then it's not in your food. And you wonder why people are not as healthy today as they were 100, 200 years ago. You wonder why these doctors and nutritionists prescribe these supplements of magnesium and zinc and all this stuff, because it's not in the food that we eat, which is where we're supposed to get it from, because we have gouged and raped and prostituted mama so bad that it's not there. And we suffer for it. You know, it took a little while, but people started understanding a little bit of what we were saying. It started penetrating, so people were listening more. But initially, people thought we were crazy. Don't comb your hair? What are you talking about? Where'd the comb come from? Did it come from life, or is it an invention of man?
I was going to say, John Africa, I read that John Africa confronted dogfighters directly and challenge them.
Absolutely.
I was wondering if you could tell us about your take on dogfighting today, especially considering its importance within some communities in the U.S. Where does MOVE stand, and where do you stand on dogfighting in particular? I know that was an issue that was important to John Africa in particular.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're opposed to it. And anytime we run into anybody that's involved in anything like that, we do give them information and confront them directly. Now, at least in Philadelphia where we're at, you don't see it much. You see it sometimes because we see pit bulls that, you know, you can tell have been fighting, bred to fight. And we get right with the owners and give them information. I don't even want to say owners, with the people that, you know, they live with. And we confront them and give them information about it, particularly, but not only, but particularly if they're black. I mean, isn't that what black people complain about during slavery? How plantation owners used to have black men fighting each other, beating each other almost to death for sport, for entertainment, to make money, you know, make wages on it and all that. And I mean, black people complain about that and see it as barbaric. But that's what they're doing to those dogs, you know? And it was really in epidemic proportions in Rochester, New York, when some of our family, including John Africa, lived up there. And, I mean, it was a just completely unacceptable situation. And whenever John Africa or MOVE people ran across that kind of situation, we stepped right to them. To us, it was no different than seeing a parent, an adult, physically abusing a child, and you just ignore it? No.
Does it? I wonder how you feel about arguments that would say, well, for some communities, some people that would be doing this, it would be a matter of making money and putting food on the table, and, you know, perhaps
poorer
communities.
Well, so is prostitution and selling drugs, but does that make it right? That doesn't make it right. Rather than perpetuate that kind of viciousness and barbarism, why not confront and deal with the system that caused a situation where you cannot eat and feed your family? I mean, that's what needs to be dealt with. You don't just do something like that as vicious as that and accept it and, well, this is what I have to do to support my family. People would not accept that if a drug dealer was hanging around a school selling drugs to kids, saying that this is what he does to make money to support his family. People would be outraged and say, well, no, you know, something's wrong. You better find something else, you know. And I'm not just saying that people have an easy time, particularly today, supporting themselves or their families. I mean, times are really, really hard for people today. But what we're saying is, I mean, at some point, don't you draw the line as to what you will do? And isn't it sensible to confront the root of the problem rather than degrade yourself and abuse life? Accept that rather than to confront what's causing you to be in this position?
We only have about, I mean, all of these questions could be shows unto themselves, so maybe maybe you'll come back
if you'll come back
and tell us more.
Last,
we have about 12 minutes left.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about, you had mentioned, briefly mentioned August 8th, 1979, and of course there was May 13th, 1985. I want to just turn it over to you if you want to tell us about the history of those very important days and events that went down, and then what happened with the MOVE 9 and what's going on now with them and Mumia Abu-Jamal. So I'll just let you take the floor.
Okay, I'll run it. Okay, just to go back a bit, I talked about our demonstrations in the 70s in defense of life. These demonstrations led to MOVE people being arrested, beat up, locked up, and the system saw that they could not buy us off. They offered us money, you know, funding to set us up in an office and all of that. And MOVE refused it because we didn't want anything from the system. We knew the work we had to do. And when the system saw that they could not buy us off and bribe us and co-opt us that way, that's when they came with the brutality and intimidation, the beatings and locking us up. And MOVE people would come right back at them, you know, demonstrate at police stations and at judges' homes who had sat in a courtroom and saw the sheriff beat MOVE people up right in front of them and do nothing, or deliberately convict or sentence MOVE people knowing that we were innocent. Anyway, things escalated. And what really brought things to a head in August of 78 is that the government tried to use this issue of housing code violations to get MOVE out of our home, to try to get us out of our home, and they claim hopefully out of Philadelphia, but that was a lie. When MOVE people would not MOVE, when we made it clear that, you know, this government doesn't care about poor people, particularly a predominantly black organization. We're not all black. There are white people in MOVE, Spanish people in MOVE, et cetera. But a predominantly black organization living in homes that have housing code violations. First of all, the violations were nothing more than like screens, not having screens in the windows, and I mean nonsense like that. And we know that they don't care about that, but they were using it as an excuse to try to say we had to MOVE out of our home. And MOVE people would not MOVE. Some MOVE people went on other activities, like in Rochester, New York, or Richmond, Virginia. But a bulk of MOVE people stayed at our home. And they used that as an excuse on August 8th of 1978 to send hundreds of cops out to our home to kill, not to arrest. That was bull. They didn't come out there to arrest MOVE people for not leaving our house or not coming to court. They came out there armed for war, to kill. And in their fury to kill MOVE people, they ended up killing one of their own cops, and no MOVE people were killed. Now, I know when me as a MOVE person says that, people will say, well, yeah, you know, what do you expect her to say? I mean, of course she's going to say that her family didn't kill this cop. But it's very clear. First of all, MOVE people did not invent the term friendly fire. The system invented that term. They invented it because apparently there were numerous situations where two groups or two people at odds ended up injuring or killing their allies. Now, they invented the term friendly fire to describe such a situation. MOVE didn't invent that. So when MOVE tells people that this cop, James Ramp, was killed by friendly fire, why should it be such a anomaly? Why should it be such a question? You know, like these things just never happen. That football player that gave up his career in football and went over to Iraq, he was killed by friendly fire. They tried to cover it up, but it came out. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
It was a football player that went over there. He was killed by friendly fire. And if his family hadn't pursued his death, they never would have known it. But he was killed by friendly fire, as was Officer James Ramp on August 8, 78. But despite that, despite the fact that he was shot with a bullet that entered the back of his neck and traveled downward, making it physically impossible for any MOVE person to have killed him, because he was standing on street level facing MOVE's home, MOVE people, all MOVE people, even by the cops' own admission, because they had gone into MOVE headquarters and went from the third floor to the second floor to the first floor and ascertained that all MOVE people were in the basement. Now, if you're in a basement 6 feet below street level, how could you shoot somebody who's standing up on street level 6 feet above you, facing you? How could you shoot them in the back of the neck and have the bullet travel downward? It's physically impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And if the government really believes that MOVE killed this cop, why would they send bulldozers out immediately after arresting MOVE people and demolish MOVE headquarters, even tear down the trees that were in MOVE's yard and around MOVE headquarters? Why would they do that? Aren't police officials and government officials trained to preserve evidence in a crime, a murder, a police murder? You know, they would have cordoned off the area and preserved everything to prove that MOVE killed that cop, but they didn't do that. They destroyed evidence, which is a crime. They demolished the scene of the crime, the scene where they're saying MOVE people killed the cop. MOVE people went to court. They were all charged with murder, conspiracy, other charges, but they were all charged with murder. How do 9 people fire one bullet from one cop? One thing if they said, well, Chuck Africa, Janine Africa, Debbie Africa, Delbert Africa, you shot this cop, but y'all were all in there together, so you're all guilty. They didn't say that. They cannot prove that any one MOVE person killed that cop. So how can they justify convicting all 9 of a murder they can't prove that even one did, and sentence each of the 9 to 30-year minimums and 100-year maximum sentences? MOVE people have been in jail 29 years. All their appeals have been denied. They come up for parole next year, and that's what we're working on. This issue of the unjust imprisonment of our family, the MOVE 9, is what MOVE people were and still are protesting, but we're definitely protesting for years after their sentencing in 1981. And this is what led to the May 13th bombing. They could not shut us up. They could not stop us from exposing this conspiracy against MOVE people, the unjust imprisonment of our innocent family members. And basically, they just determined that they couldn't shut us up, couldn't stop us, so they just had to kill us. And that's basically what it was about. They tried to say that we were a nuisance to our neighbors, that neighbors complained, and MOVE people don't even burn our energy trying to go back and forth convincing people that we weren't a nuisance to our neighborhood. What we're saying is that this government have never cared about black people complaining about their neighbors. Never. It's not even an issue with government officials. So for them to try to convince people that they came out there in May of 1985 because a handful of black people may have complained about their MOVE neighbors is absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. They came out there to get rid of us once and for all, to take the pressure off of them about the MOVE 9, about our innocent family members. Mumia Abu-Jamal from the early 70s was the only journalist reporter that accurately and consistently reported on what was really happening with MOVE. He came to court cases, he came to demonstrations. Even after MOVE people were arrested, he went up to the prison to interview MOVE people. But he also interviewed cops and officials. He interviewed the other side, too. Mumia was the only one, though, that really told the truth about what was going on and would not stop telling the truth, which made him a target of this system. And in December of 1981, December 9th, he found himself in a situation. He was a cab driver part-time because he was a freelance journalist. He could not work for, like, a company because they kept trying to control what he wrote and what he covered, and he wasn't having that. So he drove a cab part-time to help support his family, and then he just, you know, did audio commentaries and written commentaries on issues that were important to him and important to the people. While driving his cab on this one night, of course, he ran into a situation where a young black man was being beat by a cop, and Mumia discovered that it was his brother. his very own brother. And the cop ended up being shot, and they're saying Mumia shot the cop, which Mumia did not. He, you know, has affirmed his innocence from the beginning. Mumia was licensed to carry a gun, a 38 caliber gun. The original reports of the shooting of this cop said that he was shot with a 44, which he was not Mumia's gun. But of course he was convicted anyway and sentenced to death, and he's been on death row 25 years. Hello?
Okay. We still have you. We're pretty much out of time.
I'm sorry.
But we have maybe 30 seconds left if you want to give a website or tell people where to find information.
Absolutely.
The last couple words.
Yep. People can reach us. Our website is on the move, onamove.com, www.onamove.com. Our email address is on the move, onamovellja for Long Live John Africa at AOL.com, or they can reach us at 215-387-4107.
Ramona, thank you so much for being here
today.
Thank
you for the opportunity. On the move, long live John Africa and long live revolution. People better learn to respect life, because we cannot exist without life.
Thanks again. It was very inspiring to hear you talk. I hope that you will come back on the show sometime.
I absolutely will, anytime.
Thanks so much, Ramona.
All right, on the move.
Bye. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. We were just speaking with Ramona Africa from MOVE. And if you're interested in hearing this program, you can go in about a week. This will be archived on animalvoices.ca. I want to say a quick thank you to Sarah for letting us run over into her show. And thank you, Carl, for teching. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner.